Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you put our three brains into a vat, this is the film they'd make.
Yes.
Slightly sprawling, slightly incoherent, but the nub of a great idea.
Yes. And,
cast, the best cast of any British film ever made.
Oh, God. Incredible cast.
Well, let's start.
And then so many thoughts.
Let's start.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We check the recording. Right. Recording. Yep.
Britain. An ancient kingdom with legends of violence, cruelty, and torment in its blood. Join your hosts, Ross, John, and James, as they bravely tread where few would dare. Witness their journey into the horrific history of British horror. They are... The General Witchfinders.
Ladies and gentlemen, goblins and ghouls, welcome back and happy new year. Ooh. If you're listening to this in January or anywhere close to the new year. Welcome back to the 42nd episode of the General Witchfinders podcast. I'm James in Bournemouth in southern England.
I'm John Pountney and I'm questioning, when did our last episode go out? Was that New Year's Eve? Sure,
yeah, on New Year's Eve, when we recorded it on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, of course, yeah, it was live, wasn't it?
It was live. Yeah.
Okay, so this is effectively as New Year, yes?
Yeah, so but this is 2024, which is 42 backwards, isn't it? So it's numerological
okay.
Serendipity.
Get on with it.
Anyway. so I'm in South Wales, which is still in the south of Wales.
I'm Ross in Dorchester, southern England, and this time we watched Nothing But the Night.
Faces of innocence, happy and carefree. But beneath the sound of children singing, there is a hum of evil. Filling their days with the terror of the night.
A coachload of children? I can't believe that.
The children were incidental.
What?
They were accompanied by three illustrious and very rich trustees of the Van Trelen Trust.
The nature of the killing points to one thing. Ritual murder.
I want you to tell me about the fire.
No. I don't want to talk about it, please.
Try to remember. What happened?
It was so cool at first, but the fire came faster and faster.
I'd do anything to help her. I'd give my life for it. But if you're lying to me, if this is some kind of trick...
The masters of suspense, Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, unravel a web of mystery that reaches out from the confines of a hospital to a bleak island off the coast of Scotland.
Is Mary Valley well protected?
Colonel Bingham has made adequate security arrangements.
But he can't protect her from the nightmares in her mind.
Inspector, you will organize local volunteers for a search.
I want every inch of this island searched before nightfall.
Is it a mother's love or a thirst for revenge that drives her to this island? To be hunted like an animal. While the children play, disaster chills the day. And the night explodes with danger.
Nothing But the Night is a 1973 British horror film directed by Peter
Sasti. Like all of them.
And starring big Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing. It is based on the 1968 novel of the same name by John Blackburn. A commercial failure. The film was the... the script went the wrong way. Sorry. A commercial failure. The film was the only production of Charlemagne Films, of course, co-founded by Christopher Lee.
More on this later.
Yeah, okay, I won't say any more at this point. And Anthony Nelson Keyes, producer of many Hammer films. This was his last listing on IMDb, apparently.
Oh, really?
Chris Lee and Charlemagne Films optioned two other books by John Blackburn.
Portrait. This is the bit I was going to say.
Portrait of Barbara and Bury Him Darkly, which were envisaged as sequels to this movie.
Amazing.
Ooh, with Lee recreating the role of Colonel Bingham, but it didn't work out. They also
if there's a reason for AI, it's to get those. It's to get those films made, isn't it?
Yeah. They also optioned.
You notice that he's wearing his favourite jacket as Colonel.
That's my note later on. I said it's exactly the same coat that he wears as Lord Summer Isle. Yeah. Anyway, okay. Let's not spoil all this before we get into it. Right. They also optioned some of Dennis Wheatley's books, but only To the Devil a Daughter was ultimately made by Hammer. Peter Sasti also directed Taste the Blood of Dracula, Countess Dracula, Hands of the Ripper, The Stone Tape, and both series of Adrian Mole. What a CV. What a CV. Screenwriter Brian Hales wrote six stories for Doctor Who and created the Celestial Toymaker, recently brought back in the 60th anniversary episodes.
This is our tie-in, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
See, it's all planned.
Yeah, played by one-time James lookalike Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah, Doogie Howser, MD.
Correct. The Ice Warriors, and he also introduced the Ice Warriors, introduced in 1967, amazing. And the feudal planet Peladon, setting for the Curse of Peladon and its sequel, The Monster of Peladon. Along with our heroes, Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, this film also features Diana Dawes as Anna Harb. Diana Dawes, real name, Diana Mary Fluck, incredibly, came to public notice as a blonde bombshell. Was promoted by her first husband, Dennis Hamilton, mostly in sex film comedies and risque modelling.
Two-way mirrors.
Here we go. After it was revealed that Hamilton had been defrauding her, she continued to play up to her established image, and she made tabloid headlines with revelations of the celebrity sex parties reportedly held at her house with then-boyfriend Bob Monkhouse. Unbelievable. And I feel at this point, because it will come up again, if we have mentioned it before, she was also arrested by my grandfather for prostitution. Not Frankie Howard. No, my grandfather was a policeman in the Bournemouth area, and in what must have been the 1940s, he arrested her in Bournemouth for being a prostitute. So, fun facts there, everyone.
And I can also remember my maternal grandmother being quite cross with my grandfather, just getting very obsessed with Diana Dawes whenever she was on any of the films. There always used to be a black and white film being shown at my grandparents' house, and I went there.
There still is in my house.
Yeah. Next to a coal fire, which he was heating up batteries on a spade to get some more life out of them.
Wow.
There would be a Diana Dawes film on. My
less of that happens in this house, to be fair. But
okay, so we've also have Georgina Brown as Joan Foster. And this was my big breakthrough note as we watched. I thought, I recognize this woman. And it says her breakthrough role was Nancy in Oliver, a role she created in the original 1960s London production, but is most memorable to your hosts as Helena Rosensko, who is Lieutenant Worf's adopted mother in Star Trek The Next Generation.
Amazing.
And she appeared in a few episodes. Incredible. Then this film also features, oh my goodness, Keith Barron as Dr. Haynes, playing an so much to go into. And Keith Barron is most famous for playing David Pierce in the in the wildly popular ITV 1980 sitcom Juicy Free, which also featured who was the main lady in Juicy Free?
Gwen Taylor.
Yes,
Gwen Taylor,
who looks weirdly like my mum.
Oh really?
Yes, Russell Taylor. Yeah. Not so much now. She's a septuagenarian. But back in the 1980s, Gwen Taylor and my mum. There's definitely some DNA mixing going on there.
Yes.
So then and perhaps in many ways the film's antagonists, and it's quite remarkable, especially if you have been someone who's been brought up in the British Isles, is Gwyneth Strong playing the child. Mary Valley. Now, she is most famous. When she grew up, she played Cassandra. In Only Fools and Horses. So Nicholas Lyndhurst as Rodney, his wife. So to see her as a girl is weird.
And she's very, she's also very good in this as well.
Probably the best person in it, I reckon.
Yeah. Well, more of this later, but Christopher Lee is... He's not even telephone in this performance, is he? He only wakes up when they're about to burn him alive.
Yeah, somebody reminded him of the Wicker Man, and he was like, oh, hang on.
Well, hang on, yeah.
This is why I wanted to make this film.
However, Gwyneth Strong also appeared in the observation segment about Detective Samantha Smith, made for the 1990 series of The Crimson Factor. Yes! Yes, I used to love those bits on The Crimson Factor. That, and of course, The Assault Course. Those are the two
and rearranging the Perspex.
I always found that just quite dull to watch. Anyway, right, but then also making up this cast is Fulton MacKay, who is famous not only for his role Fletcher in Porridge,
but yes.
He was also in Fraggle Rock.
Or the UK version of Fraggle Rock. Which I didn't realise until that the bits where they show American version, the bits which are in like the real world. They just changed it for different countries. So there's a Canadian version, there's an American version, and there's a it's a lighthouse on or the British one, wasn't it? With but it's like a shop
with the dog
in the American one.
No way!
So the Uncle Travelling Matt stuff was recorded in different countries for whatever country they was in.
Well, that's quite clever.
Interesting.
Was it William Shatner in the American version? I'd like to see that. Fraggle. Rah, rah, rah.
It's a freckle on the wing.
And then also, so rounding out our cast is John Quatermass Robinson as Lord Fawnley, Morris Perry as Dr. Yates, and then Michael Gambon aka Dumbledore for many of our listeners, I'm sure. But then also, as well, the singing detective, more so than anything else, as Inspector Grant. Then we've got Duncan Lamont as Dr. Knight, and then Sheila Fraser, aka Aunt Beru from Star Wars, the original Aunt Beru, as Mrs. Allison. Unbelievable. And then Kathleen Bryan as Dr. Rose and Andrew McCulloch as Malcolm.
Not the young Aunt Beru who I got chucked off of a Star Wars message board by saying hubba hubba about her.
When will you learn,
two
Ross?
Words.
There's no place for that in Star Wars. No, come on, mate. No. Respect. No.
Other notable... mentions from the credits. Philip Martel, who was in charge of the music, not the score, I think the orchestration maybe, he is credited on every British film, literally almost, that he's ever made. I've looked at his IMDb and he's got 142 credits for music. So I always see his name and I think, I wonder what he did. But if he got paid £1,000 per film, imagine how rich he was in the 60s and 70s. We've got Les Bowie. I don't know. He did special effects in this. I don't know if he's any relation to David. I don't know if that's Bowie. His brother or his uncle. and obviously we've got Brian Hales, who... it's just this film is a kind of nexus point for
this British podcast.
And perhaps nothing else.
Yeah,
but it's like a whirlpool maelstrom of 1970s British horror and sci-fi, isn't it? It's absolutely mad. Charlemagne in itself. Did you see what I sent you earlier? The claim that was made about Charlemagne films.
No.
I'll find it now.
I don't know who you sent it to, but I don't think it was us.
Oh, I'm sure I did. Yeah, I said there's too much material for one episode.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, people also ask, is Christopher Lee still related to Charlemagne? I'm not sure why they'd ask if he's still related to him. Christopher Lee is descended from Emperor Charlemagne of the Holy Roman Empire, related to Robert E. Lee of the Confederate general, nearly married into the crown of Sweden, and his military service stories inspired his cousin to create James Bond.
I didn't realise they were cousins.
This is a whole separate episode for this podcast, isn't it?
Oh.
Are Christopher Lee stories true or false? You decide. Christopher Lee is related to Charlemagne, the Holy Roman Emperor from 800 AD or something.
Yeah, we'll probably find
that because he did a heavy metal concept album.
Yeah,
about
he did a concept album.
Big Chris Lee is the man.
We'll probably find out he's immortal and he actually is Charlemagne. He's,
yeah. The more I looked into this film, the more I thought this is absolutely loopy. Like,
yeah,
I love that the fact that he's called his own film production company after Charlemagne, but then he's actually related to Charlemagne. It's just mad. I mean, to all intents and purposes, this is a Hammer film if you kind of read between the lines, because it's Anthony Nelson Keyes, who was their like kind of top flight producer in the glory years. And then they must have put Christopher Lee put loads of money into this, but also, like you said, he bought out the rights to, they bought the rights to these other, to this other writer who, when I looked at this other writer's credits on Wikipedia, who is he likened to?
James Herbert.
James Herbert, yes. Podcast favourite.
Apparently, nearly all of his books are concerned with interracial marriages and stuff. Ooh. So then, but I'm not sure if it's in a positive or a negative light. So,
interesting.
There might be potentially problematic. Yeah. Could be
cancelled.
But gotta say though. It's an hour in before I was going, this isn't a horror film.
This is not a horror film. Exactly. That's what's so incredible about it.
Yeah. So I can see why maybe it didn't do as well as people expected, because it isn't, especially if you got a Lee and Cushion in it, and it takes an hour before anything slightly supernatural or
happens. I think it's a thriller, and because I'd forgotten the ending, when I last saw it, I knew the ending, and so I was a bit like, oh, that's kind of disappointing. But this time I thought, actually, this is really quite good. But obviously we'll get onto that. But it's not what you're expecting. If you're expecting Victoriana with, I mean, Peter Cushing's wearing an amazing hairpiece in it.
Again. it ticks a lot of the right boxes.
You can definitely see the join now. That, when you're aware of it, you can see I can see where that bit begins.
Yes.
I will say that it's a horror film that uses none of the tropes or conventions of horror. Until maybe the last 5 or 10 minutes.
The way
that it's shot and set up and things such as you said, it is more in keeping with a film, you know, which is a thriller. And in many ways, this is like a whodunit. There's a there's a big fake out at the end. The person who you think is going to be responsible for the murders is not responsible for the murders at all.
No.
More on that shortly. But That's and then I thought, as Russ said, I was watching it just thinking, is this going to get spooky in a minute? And then it's only like we get up to the last 15 minutes and it goes berserk.
Yeah, I love
it. And that's why I was like, this is out there. This is absolutely out there.
So, it's a great film.
So Lee made this the same year as The Wicker Man.
Yes. Yeah, and you can tell.
But I'm trying to work out which came first. Because it feels to me like there are elements of I think if it was directed by Robin Hardy, it would have been, they could make it, this might have been like the alternative for Wicker Man, I think.
To be fair, Cleves, this is better than The Wicker Man by some distance.
Ooh, I think that would be controversial.
Well, only to film nerds who think The Wicker Man is great, when actually it's a very boring film. And people only like it because it's got Britt Eklund's boobs in it and someone else's bum. And Ingrid Pitt.
And folk music. there's a lot of folk people get.
Yeah, The Wicker Man is a musical. That's that's
the music in this film is mental as well.
Yes.
So we start off with the music playing over the top of crashing waves, with a fantastic font. I think it might be called Eurostyle.
The typeface is amazing, isn't it? It's very It's very 1973. It's the kind of typeface you'd see on a tape recorder, like a reel-to-reel tape recorder, saying ultrasound or something, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, well, basically the film starts with a scene which is like an episode of Some Mothers Do Have 'Em that you may remember, where our hero is hanging off a cliff, suspended in a Morris Minor with Michel Detrice. Did we mention the story about what was engraved on the inside of his ring when he left something like Phantom of the Opera? Or-
no, sorry.
No. Oh. I'm sure this is a story that we all know, but basically...
I don't know this.
Michael Crawford, we should point out for the listeners.
Yeah. Crawford.
Condor Man.
Yeah, Crawford, he was given a ring as he was leaving some performance, and basically engraved inside the ring was the word
yes, I had heard that, yes.
So you'll bleep out the word please.
No.
But, or just take the whole story out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, but, great. It's a good one.
So basically, it starts with an old lady being seen to be pushed off a cliff in a car. Morris Minor Thousand Estate. Yeah. And then an old man dies being pushed out of a window or something by a giant boxing glove.
Mm-hmm. Everyone's got, they've got the leather gloves on, which is like, everyone has that in movies when you're going to see their hand, but you can't see if it's a man or a woman.
And then someone else gets shot in the face, don't they?
Yes.
Which did make me wince a bit when the gun goes right onto her.
Under her eye.
Horrible,
I also, my opening note was, I said, well, who knew that a Morris 1000 would explode like a nuclear weapon? When it rolls off the cliff, and instead of just like rolling end over end, about 3 feet out, it just goes...
I wrote, why would it explode at the top? Not the bottom?
I think maybe like it went off too early, but they didn't only had one car.
Yeah. I think Les Bowie was probably stood there with his little device to press to blow it up. And maybe he sneezed or he pressed it on take rather than, you know, whatever.
And then the man pushed from the balcony in what looked like a London residence. I just put, this is just like a Russian billionaire's death.
Yes.
There's been a spate of these. I don't know, for our international listeners, if they're aware of that, but like a number of Russian oligarchs have met their deaths in very, very suspicious ways, which
Now we know why.
Well, Putin is looking for immortality, isn't he?
Well, I think,
And so, this guy suddenly being, as John says, pushed out by a giant boxing glove. I was like, oh, this is very Russian billionaire's death.
But all of these people are killed. They're in some kind of like trance before.
They do look in a trance, yes, which...
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not bothered. They're not bothered in any way, shape, or form about meeting.
And it's not really explained why either, even by the end. I mean, the people who are around at the end look in... slightly in a trance, but you're not really sure what's happening at that point, are you? Let's face it.
But did you like the cut they did when the gun went off? It cut to the exhaust pipe of the bus.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, off, going off as well. Yeah.
So we're on a coach trip with a load of
annoying children.
Noisy bastard kids. Yeah. I think the driver says.
And I put fair bus driver assessment. Because as listeners may know, I'm a teacher. I've been on coaches with, and in one way, this is the changing of the times. But these days, you wouldn't have that degree of rabble because everyone's just on their phones.
Yes.
But at the same time, oh God, this just brought me out in a cold sweat, having to do long coach journeys with just kids going,
and puking.
Constantly.
I remember one girl hyperventilated on a coach somewhere and was given a bag of cheese and onion crisps to hyperventilate into, and the smell was so bad that it made her vomit. I can't remember where we're going. It was a long trip, and the bus smelt of spew for like 20 hours. I think we went to Barcelona on the coach from Leamington Spa.
Oh, the worst.
So he tries to. So the driver tries to spark up a ciggy, doesn't he, with his lighter?
Yeah. Which some of the things I read said that he sets fire to the bus by mistake or something. But that's not what I.
No,
I am.
No, there isn't a fight. I think what you find out later is that he is deliberately set on fire. I don't want to say by who at this point. Or
okay.
But
I think that he is badly burned and dies in conflagration. Yes. But the coach, they say that the coach isn't on fire, don't they?
Yes. So, do some of the children die in that fire as well? Is it just the bus driver?
No, okay. No, it's just the bus driver. Yeah.
So why does she end up in hospital then?
So just because there's been a crash. The coach has crashed.
Right. The coach crashes because the driver is dead, Cleves.
Right.
It's on a self-driving coach.
We should point out as well that the rabble, the kids are being led in song by young Mary, who is our main character in many ways. And she's getting them all to sing like 10 Green Bottles, which just sounds abysmal. Just sounds awful.
And it goes
and she's
on
like
for
ages.
Whipping
them up. Yeah. Into a frenzy. And so that's what, and I put, this is like a health and safety nightmare. It's like a public information film from the 70s. Kids, don't stand up in the aisle of a coach.
Don't
and
sing.
That was in a coach.
Children, do not sing in a coach.
Joviality can lead to death.
I understand that material on the seats. I can always remember that being really kind of like spiky and like kind of like.
Oh, yeah.
And like when you were a kid and wearing shorts and stuff, you really didn't want to have your.
Horrible. Yeah. No.
Do you remember the things on the back of the bus seats where it was so people could scrub out their cigarettes and then drop them on the floor?
Yeah. But with those seats, you always know that someone in the past has pissed themselves on those seats, don't you?
Oh.
And they're made to. Yeah, they're made to look like that, so you can't see the stains on them. Disgusting.
And if you would hit the seat back, it would release like a plume of dust, which I can only describe as being what I imagine very similar to what was let out of the nuclear reactor in Chernobyl.
So I've been told by my dentist that I've got all micro fractures all in my teeth, and I thought that was from when I came off my motorbike and hit the floor. But I think it might be because when the bus used to be idle and it'd be vibrating, you know, I used to put my teeth on the metal bar on the so it would rattle my teeth. But now maybe that's why I've got the microfractures.
Wow. Okay.
Microfractures becoming collections of five. Microfractures becoming collections of five. You can't say it very fast, can you? Do you remember that, Cleves?
No, what's that from?
Micro Machines come in collections of five. Machines come in collections of five.
You have to have the voice of Blur to do it, really, don't you?
There was a guy, again, any American listeners, you'll know who he is. His kind of shtick in the States was he could talk really, really fast. And so he was utilizing lots of ads, saying things at a really fast speed. And the ads for Micro Machines, the little tiny cars, which were craze when we were
10
kids.
Minutes.
Yeah. that was the TV ad. The ad always finished with him going, "Micro Machines coming, collections of five. Micro Machines coming, collections of five."
This is the Micro Machine Man presenting the most midget miniature motorcade of Micro Machines. Plus incredible Micro Machine pocket playsets. Each one comes with its own special edition Micro Machine vehicle and fun fantastic features in this Micro Machine service center and many more. And these playsets fit together to form a perfectly precise Micro Machine world. The Micro Machines collect and worrisome trade them from Baloo. Remember, if it doesn't say Micro Machines, it's not the real thing.
Anyway.
Like it was a big selling point.
Yeah.
James, it's what is it? Generic toddle or something
generic
like that?
Toddle,
oh, we've had another one-star review since that.
Amazing! Come on, bring it on, please. Bring it on.
If it's on there.
Is this somebody I've wronged?
I don't know. Is this somebody I've right. If I read it out, that means someone's got to give us a five-star review in order to cancel
it
out.
No, it doesn't. Come on.
One-star review. This is not a call for one-star reviews, and you will not get read out just to get if you give
it. It really is.
It's not. Okay, this is by Dan J. Hardy. One star, the one word title,
review.
Awful.
Great.
Just more unfunny blokes sat laughing at their own, in inverted commas, jokes, deeply banal stuff.
Great. Yes. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks Dan. For listening, mate.
Cheers for that.
I'm glad you carried on listening.
Craig's assessment.
Yeah. Looking forward to episode 43, he says. I mean, Ellis and John, whatever his name is, got on Five Live talking this amount of shit, didn't they? So maybe we'll... all they do is talk about fucking Queen.
Hold on, yeah. So the coach crashes and we then cut to seeing young Mary in hospital, bandaged head, and we're told that even though she only has superficial wounds, cuts and scrapes, she's
doolally
out. And Keith Barron, aka Dr. Haynes, who we learn is basically a psychologist rather than a MD.
He's a shrink.
Like, oh. Yes. He's like, oh, perhaps some hypnotherapy could bring her out of this, so on and so forth. He then decides, he decides that he needs to get permission from this or for this or what have you. Yeah. And that is when we get, and my notes just say yes. And now I remember it's because we then get Cushing and Lee.
Yeah. The Cushing has landed.
Yeah.
Who's in his own department with his own name over the
aim. Yeah. Well, he's got a whole wing, yeah. Peter Cushing. Yeah. It's awesome. It looks very, very similar to the high security facility from Life Force, doesn't it?
Lots of glass. It's basically, I have written, this is what, in my mind, this is what hospitals still look like. When you go to hospitals now, they're very like, they're horrible now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. But in the 70s, they look kind of quite airy, quite spacious.
Yeah, with ramps and shit like that.
Yeah, a bit of design flair now. They're just horrible, white, clean surfaces everywhere, aren't they? And they smell really very terrifying.
That's what a cigarette smoke like they should do.
No. So, yeah, we're introduced to Sir Mark.
Mm.
Which one is he?
Cushing.
That's Peter Cushing.
That's Cushing, is it? And then so basically I've put Sir Mark, Cushing and Lee, fine men.
Yeah.
So yes. We're introduced to them quite simultaneously. Are we at this point?
Yeah, they're hanging out. They're hanging out together already when Keith Barron turns up.
Oh, really? Pals.
Christopher Lee was just trying to bring him on board to help him because Christopher Lee is coming out of retirement in order to solve
this
mystery, which is personal this time.
That's the deaths of the... Yeah, I noted
the
down
three
the
three trustees.
Yeah.
Yes. Who we are now introduced
to. So this is Christopher Lee's character from Deathline, obviously, isn't it? In the bowler hat.
Yeah.
He comes in as the MI5. So all these films somehow link up, I think, across their own Marvel-esque universe where there's a sinister... There's a sinister world, a sinister underworld in 1971 to 73 London, isn't there?
Yeah, and Christopher Lee is the nexus point for all.
Well, he is, yeah. I mean, at one point, one of his alter egos is trying to resurrect the bubonic plague to kill all of humanity.
Or is it a case of when he's got the moustache, he's playing the same character?
He's a good guy.
Yes.
No tash.
Yes.
Bad guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Wicker Man isn't in this... universe.
But
I don't know why I'm sneezing.
He has a tash in Death Line. He has a tash in the
Horror, the other railway one.
Horror Express.
Horror Express. Yeah,
canonical.
But that's not
set in 1971, please.
No, but we have established that he is immortal and he's actually Sharma.
He's an eternal.
Yeah.
But then he's got a beard when he's in Star Wars and he's about that's bad.
Oh.
Same with Lord of the Rings. He's back in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Oh man, this is turning into a thesis. Anyway, right. So what we learn is that I said the one thing that I noticed was Christopher Lee has a remarkable way of saying the word suicide. Did you guys notice this? And I said, he says it suicide. Try it out at home, guys, if you want. Suicide.
Suicide. It's a suicide. Do you remember that song? Suicide. It's a suicide. It's an amazing tune. You'll have to put it on the podcast somewhere,
okay.
Please.
Oh, I'll check it. I'll get it.
It's by the Gravediggers.
Suicide. It's a suicide. Suicide. It's a suicide. Suicide. It's a suicide. Suicide. It's a suicide. You wanna die, commit
suicide, dial 1-800. It came out in 1994, I think.
Wow. So, so we find out through the conversation of the three men that Christopher Lee wants Peter Cushing, Sir Mark Ashley's involvement, because he's like, there's something afoot here. These three trustees of this charity, which
the
looks
Van
after
Traylen orphanage,
which looks after children. We don't learn to start off with that it's set on an island in the middle of Scotland,
and there's only about 10 children there.
Yes, on the outskirts of Scotland. We don't learn that yet, but that is the deal with it. He thinks that there's more going on than just suicide. And Peter Cushing is, would we say, slightly reluctant to start off with?
Well, basically, he's just lost his wife, Helen, and he thinks, what I want to do is sleep in bed with Christopher Lee for 6 weeks while we make this film.
Watching Looney Tunes cartoons. Remember?
I'll go along with whatever you say, Christopher. Okay.
Yeah.
Charlemagne, if you want me to call you Charlemagne.
Charlemagne, so be it. And then I've also pointed out my other note just says Big Chris Lee smiling under duress here, like he's in a hostage video. Like when he smiles, he never looks comfortable, does he?
No.
As a character.
No. Or like as that. A person. Yeah. There is a weird sequence in this where someone says, please, at the end of a sentence.
Yeah, like because they realise they've been rude towards them.
I thought, why is that a thing in this film, that within 5 minutes there's two people and then they never do it again? I thought...
That's the first time anyone is polite. Later on, when we get to Keith Barron and the reporter, it's just that strange kind of confrontational kind of... relationship
dialogue.
They have. Yeah, it was just...
Which,
is this
strange.
When she slides onto the floor in a kind of sexual way?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, we'll get there in a minute.
Just to say, the guy who did the voice for the Micro Machines is called John Moschetta Jr.
That's him.
Yeah, and he was in loads of things, including Dick Tracy. And he was in episodes of The A-Team and
The A-Team is still alive. His time, yeah. Like cocaine.
Is he still alive?
He's got a big Wilf Lung moustache on the
great.
Well, he was born in 1954, so and
he's still alive.
Yeah, he's still alive. Still alive.
Sorry, John.
Still alive. Have we got to the scene yet where Diana Dawes goes, you tight little hustler.
Hustler.
She's just turned up now. She's just turned up at the hospital demanding to see her.
Oh, yes. Yes. So she goes to the hospital first, doesn't she?
Yes. Because we should point out, she's one of the main characters in this, that we learn that Mary, who is in this comatose state, who was leading the singing on the bus, her mum is Diana Dawes, a.k.a. Anna Harb, as she's called in this. And there's only one word to describe. She's brassy.
She's like Cat Slater.
Yes, very much so. There's a couple of scenes where she just pushes people out of the way who aren't in her way.
It's
brilliant.
So she wants to see a kid and they kick her out. And then,
we learn that it's
Let
her
me see
daughter,
my kid.
But her daughter had been taken away from her. Mm-hmm. That we learn that because she'd been sent to prison for murdering three people.
And being a prostitute.
But then how she's got out, we don't know.
Where had she been? Broadmoor or somewhere like that, was it?
That's what they said.
Yeah,
so right now, out you go. Jimmy Savile saw to her release or something like that. And then it's not made explicit, but it's clear that Diana Dawes is involved in some sort of fortune-telling mysticism hijinks.
Oh. That part isn't...
You can tell from her car, which I described as a hippie movie.
She's got
cards
and a weird picture
eyes.
Of a cat on the front of it.
Yeah, drawn all over her car.
Actually,
and
that makes more sense to me now that when you find out at the ending that there's some kind of inherited... things
So she's an interesting character. She says, look, they took my daughter off me, I want her back, and they're like, look, you can't have her back, she's being looked after now by the whatever foundation
she goes to the papers to try and get help,
the Van Traylen orphanage.
Thank you. Those are the guys.
The big tabloid newspaper she goes to is called the Daily Echo, which is like there's no big newspaper called the Echo, is there?
No,
there are no big papers called the Echo.
No, it's just like shitty little local rags.
Correct.
Yeah. Are we talking about the Cardiff Echo here, or something that James has had a previous friction with?
That would be correct.
Western Mail and Echo. Western Mail and Echo. You don't hear that in Cardiff now because they don't sell it on the street anymore.
Do not.
No.
Do they still have the man singing into the Echo mic?
He's dead.
Oh.
Toy Mike Trev. He's dead.
The guy used to dress up as Charlie Chaplin, but whoop, he's dead, isn't he, James?
I think he's gone. Yeah. The guy, Gordon the Tramp, who always knows what time it was, he's no longer with us.
Plinky Plonk, he's gone.
Plinky Plonk's gone, long gone.
So Plinky Plonk was a tramp, he used to play a one-string guitar.
Yeah. Mr. Shaky Hand Man in Cardiff died as well. Oh God, he's still going, probably. Fucking hell. You don't see people like that anymore, do you? And I do wonder if
famous tramps.
What has become of the great British eccentric?
Yeah. There's another podcast.
Like tramp.
Yeah. Famous tramps.
Who is your tramp in your area?
With us three on the cover dressed as tramps.
Tramps.
Blacked out teeth.
Yeah, a bit like the two Ronnies when they did the...
Yeah,
leaning on the gate and stuff, didn't they?
Oh, that was good.
I used to love that.
Oh, fantastic. Right, so...
More twaddle, more generic.
Yes, this is banal. More laughing at their own jokes. Oh,
awful.
So Diana Dawes, the poor quality newspaper that she contacts, says, yeah, all right, we'll send a journalist round. And this is
Shirley Ballas from Strictly.
Yeah, John says she looks like Shirley Ballas. I will point out that said, because when I saw her face, I was like, I know her from something, and I know. Thank God for IMDb, because I looked her up and straight away I was like, yo, it's Wolf's mum.
She does look a bit like Mariona Curtis as well, which is a bit weird.
Weird, but what I will say is,
it up like Shagging.
There's one for the Freudians in the audience.
For the fan fiction that Cleaver's written.
In his head, yeah. But I will point out that even though, you know, I prefer a lady's curvier, she was a very attractive woman in the 70s.
It's very attractive.
She's very lovely. I saw her, sure. Oh, yeah, I'm on board. So, yeah, and she has magnificent hats as well. You don't get journalists in big hats like this anymore.
That was the working title of this film.
Yeah.
Magnificent Hats, yes.
It's Magnificent Man.
So she first of all, she speaks to Diana Dawes and, you know, gets more of her backstory from her, resulting in the aforementioned shot that John spoke about. There's only one crash zoom in this film, and it's in the bit where it zooms in on Diana Dawes and she says, "You tight little hustler," to her, which is wow, what a put down.
But her flat didn't look like a set to me. That looked like someone's real flat.
It looked amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd move in there. That looked great, I thought. I can't remember what happens after this, but we then introduce to a very Stone Tape-esque scene where Peter Cushing does Angry in the style of Michael Bryant in
Stone Tape.
The Stone Tape, in, you know what the rat looks like, country boy, or whatever. Whatever the line is.
Yeah.
So Cushing, I've never seen Cushing do really angry like that before.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of bits of unprovoked anger comes out of him a little bit, doesn't it? I think they're just desperate to give him something to do, because essentially he's just looking in test tubes the whole time. And
mostly, yes. I don't know if this is down to Peter Sarsdy, the director, who up to this point, and including this film, had done some really top-notch directing jobs. Countess Dracula is one of the best latter Hammer films. Hands of the Ripper is very, very good. This is a very well-directed film. The Stone Tape, obviously, is the pinnacle of this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So and Peter Sarsdy is still alive.
Wow.
So if we could get him on as a guest or go and meet him, that would be the ultimate kind of thing, wouldn't it? But anyway, where are we up to? I think there's lots of different threads in this film at the moment, isn't there? And they don't feel necessarily very balanced. There's lots of plates spinning.
First
and
time
just
I watched it, I was like, I don't know what's happening. I don't get this at all.
But that's every film we watch, Cleves.
Is that the journalist, Shirley Ballas, Worf's mum, Georgina Brown, she says, yes, all right, I'll look into this case for you and I'll start to ask around. Meanwhile, we then do get Keith Barron does do his hypnotherapy on young Mary.
Yes.
And she starts kind of giving it this whole, oh, the fire.
Yeah.
Won't someone come and help me? The fire.
Did she talk about someone called Vincent or something
And then very, very confident Keith Barron says, well, thank you. And you will forget everything that just happened to you in 3, 2, 1. And and she's fine. And you go, ha, 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 I feel great. And then they say, well, but this is really weird because the coach didn't catch on fire. She's not been in a fire.
Mm.
So where has she got this memory of a fire from? Mm. Which really, once you know where the film is going, that is the core mystery.
Yes.
They just basically just let it fall by the wayside.
Exactly,
entirely.
Yes.
How has she got memories of things she's not experienced?
Which is ultimately a very interesting idea.
It is.
But yeah, as you say, James, they do kind of let once Keith Barron is kind of ejected from this film,
unceremoniously,
Paul Marion in Psycho, he dies within the first 30 minutes. And you're like, I thought he's, you know, which is quite a brave thing to do because he's a principal character. But then you're just a bit like, what's the investigation into that part just kind of.
But I think maybe what they're trying to do is kind of hide the, what's actually going on to try and keep it a bit more mysterious. But
yes,
but because they do that, you don't know what thread to hang on to, because it's just like you said, there's lots of things up in the air, and you're like, well, I don't know what is the mystery we're trying to solve here.
Yeah, so
they're desperately trying to push it all towards Diana Dawes as being.
We've got the mother, haven't you? You've got the kid with the false memories. You've got the murders that are being investigated, and it's I don't want to say it's badly directed, really, because it isn't, but you're not really sure what's going on at that point, are you? Because there's quite a lot going on. And I think it's quite rushed, maybe, at that point. Whereas later on, there are parts when Diana Dawes is crawling through a bush for the 14th time.
Yeah.
They literally, that doesn't need to be in there, does it, at that point?
No.
So then we've got.
They go and have a cup of tea in the indoor market.
Yeah, Shirley Ballas and Keith Barron.
There you go. Who is they? Once again, me having to be the teacher.
Watching
here.
It on the screen. Yeah,
yeah. Yes.
So Keith Barron, as the doctor, then meets, inevitably, what's happened is in her investigation, Joan Foster, the reporter, meets Dr. Haynes, who's Keith Barron, and says, well, can you tell me what's going on with this girl? And he's like, well, I can't talk to you about it in hospital. Okay, we'll meet up outside of hospital.
We go
and
to the
they
market.
Then have a really weird day at a market, at a covered market,
which reminded me of that.
It reminded me of that one guy, so that one that's in Cardiff.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know the one I'm talking about.
Is it still there?
Yeah. In Cardiff, in the market.
So it feels like that. And amazingly, they walk past one of the stalls which has a sign just saying live eels.
Yeah.
I thought was terrific.
And there's a pipe event going on as well.
There's all sorts of weirdness. And so once again, this is a typical kind of getting to know you. As John says, it does give you the feeling that Keith Barron's going to be one of the main characters. Mm. And there's more kind of, it's all very mysterious, the human mind. Uh-huh. Once again. And then, as Ross mentioned earlier, the next scene is they go back to Keith Barron's flat. And despite the fact that earlier in the day, it's been all business. Their conversation has been all business. And somewhat antagonistic, I'd say. Yeah. Guys, would you agree?
Yeah, yeah. Really, kind of really aggressive.
Don't you say that about me? Yeah. Or whatever. And then, like, literally 3 hours later, they start having sex. And it's like, where has this come from?
You don't see that. You see a kind of sultry look from Keith Barron.
Yeah, and the music goes all...
She slides provocatively from the sofa onto the floor.
Yeah.
And then it's just so
weird. But you can imagine was a James Herbert-esque novel, that we would have five pages of
very explicit.
We'd have a whole chapter.
This was my other big bit of notes, though. This is that, first of all, they turn up in Keith Barrett's flat, and I just put, what is going on with his flat?
So much furniture.
It's the weirdest 70s flat you've ever seen, in that it's for all intents and purposes, it's one big room, but the room is kind of bisected by kind of shelving that you can walk through.
Yeah.
And the shelving, the big things that he's got on the top level of the shelving, is a large model of a 1920s car and a model of a railway engine.
I didn't notice that.
It's definitely, I think this is not a set. I think this is a real place, because it's way
so
over.
Bizarre. Set dressed. It's really, really
weird. It probably is someone's house. It's a fascinating film. It's a real time capsule, and that's why I really enjoy it, because it looks. A lot of the settings are, I think, just, let's do it in a Jim's got a flat. We can film it there for nothing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, let's go over to Jim's flat. And then it's just, very, very quickly dressed kind of actual place, isn't it? Rather than.
But it's interesting, the camera movements in this, because I was watching a thing recently about saying in the 70s they used to do a lot of storytelling with camera movements, but now in modern films they just pretty much lock the camera off.
Camera work now is very boring compared to 70s films.
Yeah, whereas like on this film, if someone moves, the camera sweeps around to the next place, sweeps around to the next, moves in. It's just a lot more interesting movements on there.
Yeah.
What about a drink?
Biscuits?
No, thanks. All your sexy books?
Yes. They're mostly technical.
Peter? Yeah. Is Mary Valley in danger?
Your symptoms are always serious, especially in a child.
What's your diagnosis?
I'm not sure yet. But I must explain her morbid fascination for fire. A nightmare about a blaze where she practically feels she's being burnt alive.
Well, and then the one other bit that I really want to stress this is there's the line as there, you know, as it becomes clear with the sultry sax music that there's, you know, that something is afoot here. She walks up to his desk and the line is, she goes, "Ooh, all your sexy books." And what I put is, now look, everyone, we watch some ridiculous things on this. And I'm a man, I own a lot of books. I'm not ashamed to say that. I'm very happy. No one has ever walked into my room full of books and gone, "Oh, look at all your sexy books.
Books."
People just go, "Why have you got so much shit? Why have you got all this?"
And his tape recorder. Diana Dawes at this point was 42. Books.
Wow. Hard times. People did have harder lives, yeah, as we've discussed before.
And they smoked like 70 fags a day as
that
well.
That is also true.
So then there's a scene where all I've written is Dawes, 42. Honestly, that's what I've written.
Yep.
I'll murder you. So
I'll
who does she threaten
murder
to?
You,
yeah, who does she? Does she
hospital
threaten
staff?
Oh, is it? Is that what happens?
Because yet again, she feels that her daughter is in danger, which again, what we now know from about the end of the film is probably like some kind of, you know, psychic link, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. Although again, that's never really expressed. Mm. And she turns up at the hospital and says, "I'll bloody murder you," so on and so forth. And then it's another one of her incredible storming out sequences where she pushes people out of the way who are not in her way.
Yes.
And then we suddenly see, dun, 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 yeah. Keith Barron has been killed by some costume jewelry.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's really weird to see what's going on. It just looks like he's got like a hairpin in.
Yeah, a big star on it. Yeah.
But the big, but yeah, it's clear he's been stabbed through the brain by a hairpin. Thus, and it's like, oh, shock. So
yeah, well, I wasn't expecting that. I'd forgotten that happens. Hmm. And I thought, oh, that's quite that. It's the first of two big surprises for me in this film.
Yes.
And I watch so many of these films that I know them right at the back of my hand, and I'm not surprised very often. But this film surprised me twice, which, fair play, is a lot of surprises. It's a lot more surprises than anything, really, these days.
It's worth pointing out that Joan Foster, the journalist, she is utterly nonplussed about his death.
Yes.
When you see her again later on, she makes no mention of him whatsoever.
No,
maybe
no.
She was just doing her journalistic duty to try and get the scoop on the story.
Yeah,
might have been cut out. But
I'm sure
think
at one point later on, she said to Peter Cushing that she loved him. And I thought,
She said she liked him a lot.
Yeah.
But they only met each other for the process of one day.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yes, once again, what the film leads you to believe is that, Diana Dawes has killed him.
Yes.
With the hat pin.
Yes.
And we then see that, what we're then told as well is, after all this, is that young Mary is now being whisked back to Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
They are taking her back up to Scotland to the orphanage. And then that is when we cut to Diana Dawes and her hippie mobile is clearly heading to Scotland as well.
Like, and with Nell and I making time on the M1.
Absolutely that. And John, I love seeing 1970s motorway footage.
Yes.
Because there's just nothing on the roads.
No.
You could literally sit down in the fast lane and have a three-course meal and get through in time. There's just no cars on the road.
No.
It's beautiful to see. So, yeah, so we have a good bit of footage of Diana Dawes bombing northwards.
Yes.
And then Christopher Lee and Pete Cushing believe, she's probably behind all this, and she's probably going to go and try and kill all the other trustees.
Well, they get that.
Must
from,
get to Scotland.
They get that from going to a very strange scene where they go to someone who's got a computer who they put all of the facts into.
I've forgotten that bit.
And it prints out all the kind of
suppositions.
Yeah, exactly. So they can read it all out. And
yes.
And I've got to say, the computer operator is definitely around and like when I was looking at that.
Was he?
Yeah.
No. All right. Okay. I'll take
so yeah, we
it.
Move to Scotland, right. And then for some reason the music starts referencing 10 green bottles
again,
which,
like it was on the coach, because I just thought that's what they were singing on the coach.
Yeah, so I thought,
yeah, but it is an odd choice.
I'm not sure about that one, please.
Yeah.
It's an odd choice because it's not It's not referenced again, is it? It's like you're referencing something that you then forget. Oh, no,
they keep bringing it back. It's a recurring theme. It's recurring motif.
A motif.
But it doesn't. It's not revealed in the storyline, is it?
But I think so. It's talking about all the people they're killing off.
Are there 10 of them?
I'm not sure. If there is, that would make sense. But I think that's what it's referring to.
Maybe we found that out.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So then we see that the journalist seems to now have the keys to Keith Barron's gaff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Obviously, there's no police there. He's just been murdered. No one knows who's murdered him at that point. There's a key suspect, but, you know, there's no investigation in his flat. She lets herself into the flat, mm-hmm. and then she starts listening to his tape recordings of the hypnotized Cassandra, yes. mm-hmm. yeah. Going through her memories, that are they her memories or are they someone else's memories? Mm.
Yeah. Again, with hindsight, we're making that sort of importance to these parts of it, but I don't, yeah.
It's not that obvious.
And then we have sort of a few Wicker Man-esque aerial shots of the islands of Scotland.
Yeah. Strong Summer Isle vibes again, isn't it? Very, very
and
Summer
Isle. And we have the ferry going across with the few cars going over to the island on there, which is it's a nice cool little shot. But then we see that Diana Dawes is seeing that the police are checking all the cars who are coming onto the island on the ferry, so she abandons her hippie mobile and goes on foot so that basically they don't catch her coming on.
And then one of the policemen is a stalwart of British sitcoms, but I couldn't remember his name. And I don't know if he was Harold and Hilda from Last of the Summer Wine or something like that. Were they Last of the Summer Wine?
Yeah,
or was that Ever?
Harold and Hilda for Ever Decreasing Circles.
Ever Decreasing yes. Circles,
but,
yeah.
But also often turned up on Noel's House Party for some reason.
He was also the scientist in one of the scientists in Flash Gordon, isn't he?
So I think he's one of the police officers in this who says, we're looking for a Rover 2000, not a Hillman, whatever it is. Yeah. What I want to say at this point is that the Hillman at this point, when this was made, could have been like 10 to 15 years old. And obviously in this film, it looks about 400 years old, mm-hmm. doesn't it? Like, why did cars age so quickly in the 50s and 60s? Like, it's covered in rust. Yeah. It looks fucked. And you see 25-year-old cars now and they still look like brand new cars, don't they? It's very strange.
But saying that, I haven't seen a Ford car. Like,
oh, I know, yeah,
ever.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happened to all of them?
Yeah,
they were already popular at one point.
Yeah, they've gone, haven't they? Yeah. So then Gwyneth Strong, TV's Cassandra, is back in the mansion or whatever it is. I mean, it doesn't look like an orphanage, does it? It looks like a mansion. Mm. Mm. And the lady who is Luke Skywalker's mother. Oh, mm. I mean, is she his real aunt, James,
in
Star Wars lore?
Through marriage, because Anakin's mum married Cleeg Lars, who's Owen Lars's dad.
Right.
And Owen marries Aunt Beru.
Yeah.
Right, so
and it would be the last place Darth Vader would look.
Would think. because he was so traumatised by all that, Ross. He doesn't want to go back to the scene of his trauma.
Where the, what were they called? The Tusken Raiders.
Tusken Raiders.
So yeah, so she brings in some hot milk and biscuits for the little girl. I can't imagine anything worse than hot milk. It sounds absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, I can remember as a child, a couple of times people would give it to me thinking it was a nice thing to do, and you were like,
Who were these people, Cliff?
The thing that I really hate about any hot milk drink, and I don't know why I say it, but I hate the skin that you get on hot milk.
God.
Yeah.
I've always had to peel it off. Ugh.
And when I'm trying to clean it out the bottom of a pan when it's gone all yellow. Yeah.
The smell of it. Good God. This is what
star review.
This is what the listener tunes in for, isn't it? So then we're introduced to Kathleen Byron, who has previously starred with our friend Peter in Twins of Evil, where she plays his wife in Twins of Evil. She's also famously Sister Ruth in Black Narcissus. Mm-hmm. Amazing, pivotal performance in that. And then I've just written, Jet equates speedy response.
Yes.
So Peter and Chris are
jetted off there.
They're on the trail, aren't they?
Yeah. So I don't know why Peter Cushing's brought along.
No, there's no reason. There's no reason to bring a pathologist. But they go on a jet to Edinburgh Airport, which you see in a subtitle.
Yeah.
But I just love that you needed two shots of a jet plane taking off and landing to show that they're speeding there to make some kind of response.
Yeah, and a shot inside the plane as well.
Yeah, where all they're doing is talking about the case.
Yeah.
What boring bastards.
And what a waste of money.
What did you do on the weekend, Sir Mark? You know, how's the wife? Oh, sorry, I forgot your wife passed away quite recently, didn't
you? I've been researching my family history. Etc.
Also, like,
did I ever tell you some of my war stories?
That's not how you kill a man. You did know that J.R.R. Tolkien was a friend of mine, and he did say that if there ever was a film to be made of Lord of the Rings, that I should play Gandalf.
I was cut out of the final segment, which was a very big trauma to me. That's true, isn't it? Because I heard him. I remember listening to Christopher Lee bigging up, what's his name that did the
Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, bigging him up massively with Simon Mayo on 5 Live. And then when the film was released, they'd cut him out of the last segment. And I just remember thinking, that Peter Jackson's a twat, isn't he?
But not
imagine doing that to Christopher Lee.
Yeah. But not Michael Jackson, as I thought it was when I first heard. Because I never heard of Peter Jackson. And I misunderstood, and I thought that Michael Jackson was making the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Imagine what that would be like.
You know, guys, I think I'm going to cut out the Tom Bombadil sequence.
Whatever.
Yeah. A big part for Bubbles.
Yeah.
Captain EO, that's enough.
So then we see Gambon, don't we? He comes in as a policeman.
Did you recognise him?
Yes, straight away.
Straight away. Oh,
okay. Yeah.
I thought there was a mistake on IMDb. I had to go back afterwards. It's definitely not in this film.
So introduced him as a policeman, and then... So I've written now, so the peril is protecting the girl. No mention of the fire stuff again.
Mm-hmm. No.
So at this point, they're now trying to protect the girl from the mother, aren't they?
Yeah.
They think it's Diana Dawes. That Diana Dawes is coming up there to kill them all.
Yeah.
But at that point, do they think she's killed the... Doctor. Whoever the Van Traylen people. Did they think she's killed them as well?
When they're coming across on the boat... They see another boat coming on, which has got...
Well, yes, this is the second surprise.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I thought they were already on the island, so I didn't know why they were going on a boat.
Yeah, because they just got the plane to Scotland, now they're going to get a boat to the islands.
I see. So then they're going across on the boat with all the tourists, all the journalists. Press.
Yeah, because it's a massive story. It's on the front page of all the newspapers, which
Christopher
Lee's
some point. Not very happy about that, is he? No, he's like, good. Filth, all the filth, the scum, indeed. The venal.
This brood of tabloid vultures.
Yes, he correctly identifies
them as.
Dear listener, don't Google why James is like that about a small-time, backwater town, petty, minded journalism. So anyway, I've forgotten where I was. So we're on the boat. And then for the second time in this film, I was surprised to see that the other boat explodes. And it's done really well because it's just Fulton MacKay just, talking shit. And then boom, the other boat blows up and it's like, oh. So it's another load of the Van Traylen. What are they called? The trustees?
Yes.
So another load of the trustees have been bumped off. We don't know how they've been bumped off. Well, we see how they've been bumped off, but it's never explained how that has happened. Mm.
I had the feeling because we see that there's a building site on the island, or there's some kind of excavation work happening, and the poorest secured shed in Christendom has been broken into, and explosives have been stolen from it.
But they don't show who does that. And it's never elaborated on, is it?
They want you to think it's Diana Dawes.
I thought it was Diana Dawes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So who? So.
But I thought that they were showing that because later on, so we won't, I'm not going to spoil who, but later on, someone's got a load of explosives around their neck.
On them. Yeah.
Have they?
Yeah.
Yes.
I thought they were just fireworks.
No, I thought they were the explosives. Yeah. That's why Christopher Lee was going mental.
Anyway, it's not too important.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Following this explosion, they decide that they've got to ramp up. They have got to scour the island for Diana Dawes, who has somehow managed to evade capture. And the journalists are all very sassy to them about how many coppers they've got looking for
her.
My notes simply say, they needed my granddad on this search. he would have sussed out Diana Dawes in seconds.
He got previous.
Under the pier.
Yeah, you got it. Ted Ruffle would have got him. Right, but anyway, so yes, the search intensifies. They can't find her at all.
Cutting to her like scrabbling through the undergrowth with like really, really dramatic music for not very much dramatic
no,
stuff.
She's eating an apple, then she eats a chocolate bar. During this process, you hear the immortal phrase cottage hospital.
Yeah.
I'd really love to visit a cottage hospital because they're in every Doctor Who story between 1970 and 74 has got a cottage hospital in it. And it's like, what is a cottage hospital?
Well, I was talking to my daughter about one. That was just the other day because she was saying, we was in Dorchester Hospital.
Yes.
She said, is there a hospital on the island of Portland, which is just off there? And I said, I think they got a little cottage hospital.
But what is a cottage hospital, please?
It's just a little small hospital where people can go, and if they're not near a bigger hospital, to go and get treatment. And like I think like a nurse or doctor goes there for certain...
Is it more comfortable than a normal hospital? Because cottage to me makes it sound quite cosy and nice. And kind of, you know, like, oh, cottage hospital. That sounds... I'd quite like to go to a cottage hospital.
So I went straight to a cottaging when you started talking about...
You would.
Well, obviously, yeah.
Right. So what I should also point out is at this point
and
in the film...
And take that out as well because it's offensive.
To who?
Cottagers.
That, incredibly, with 21 minutes to go,
this film now gets dark. This is when it starts happening, James.
Yes, we are told that one of the orphans has gone missing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this adds to the peril. Mm-hmm. He turns up dead pretty quick in what is quite a nasty...
It is really nasty.
It's quite like nasty when they find him. He's had like occult symbols carved into him. And I just put, blimey,
he's been stabbed 32 times or something.
Twice.
Yeah. And this is when I was like, oh, hang on.
Ritual.
This is a horror movie after all.
Yeah. With 21 minutes to go. I've got 21 minutes to go. Right. So with that, everything begins to intensify. We learn that the kids... of the orphanage are going to be having a bonfire night, huge bonfire. And we see TV's Cassandra, the young girl, is like, it's going to be the biggest bonfire ever.
Yeah.
And you can just tell, like, this isn't going to end well.
And the police are told that, look, you're not coming in here, but you can stay outside the gates. And look,
it infuriated me at that point.
Why's that?
Well, it's because... nine people have died now, and it's like they're organising a bonfire. Aren't they worried that nine people that they knew have died?
Yeah.
And then secondly,
associated with this place.
Yeah. And then you just let the cops in, wouldn't you? You wouldn't be like, oh, actually, we've got to keep the children safe. They don't know what's happened. And it's like...
But they're all in on it, aren't they?
They're all in on it.
But they said that, like, you've got...
Oh, you've given it away now, please. You're going to have to edit that out.
But essentially, they're told that... your police can just patrol the perimeter because on all sides we've got a fence apart from the back here, which is just the sea. And we're
just
on top of
just a sheer drop.
Sheer
down
drop
the
into the sea, which is the best place to have an orphanage with children running around, isn't it?
Definitely. 100%.
All I've written at this point is call in unit.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they be worried?
Lots of helicopter shots coming up.
The other two strands of the plot are that the journalist goes to Peter Cushing and then says, I think there's something up here. Listen to Keith Barron's tapes. He listens to Keith Barron's tapes. And he's like, that's very bizarre. And, you know, and then with that, Keith we get Barron a nice. FM. Yeah. And then listen to Keith Barron's mixtapes. And we then get from Peter Cushing, as someone who's done a fair bit on philosophy of mind and neuroscience, what I can only describe as a lot of old twaddle about the brain. And long story short, dear listener, what we find out is that the people or the woman who was in charge of the orphanage, they were involved in top people working for them. And they were involved in experiments wherein they could encode all of their memories and then somehow download their memories, dun, 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 into a new person. So what we learned is despite the fact that at the start, those murders, as we said, with everyone looking very, very placid about their coming deaths, all of those elaborately staged murders at the start were just basically those people, you know, dying out of their old bodies.
Yes.
Because their memories have already been encoded somewhere else and they are now going to be downloaded into the fertile minds of the young orphans.
So, and I took it that they've been wiped. That's why they were like passive and not moving.
It's been a download.
Yes.
Yeah.
So their brain, you know, their memories have all been downloaded.
Did they explain how?
No, as I said, it was just twaddly business to do with hypnotherapy and things like that. And you know, computers were mentioned at some point. Mm-hmm. Because remember, they say that guy who turns up on the island and says, oh, yes, the two people that were here, they were the top people in their field. You were just supposed to think, oh, well, they had a couple of experts here who really knew about encoding memory, which in 1972, bearing in mind the state of the computer that we saw, you absolutely could not do it any way, shape, or form.
So at this point, Christopher Lee remembers he's in this film and decides that he's going to do something.
What?
Yes. Get out!
And he's like, right, I am going to go and charge up to the orphanage. I'm going to get involved.
Yeah.
We have also seen earlier that Diana Dawes has snuck in.
Yeah.
But yes.
And again, there's still, you know, up until this point, you should have been thinking, oh, maybe Diana Dawes is going to kill them. Of course, it turns out Diana Dawes hasn't killed any of these people. She has just been trying to get her daughter back.
Yes.
And all of the murders have been carried out by TV's Cassandra.
Yeah.
The mastermind is young Mary.
It's a great reveal.
Really Mary. Yeah. It is a great reveal.
Yeah. And all the fireworks going off, and then the children are all dressed in the clothes of
miniature
old
naval
lives.
Yeah. I love
sinister
that bit.
And
I
creepy.
Think that bit is brilliant.
Yeah, and then they reveal that the guy, which is on a big stick above the bonfire, is actually the dead Diana Dawes.
I think she's still alive.
She's still alive.
With
dynamite
around
her neck.
Yeah.
And that's what we were saying earlier. That's where the dynamite's gone.
Yes.
They've stolen the dynamite to tie around Diana Dawes. And they then kind of drop
her onto the fire.
The fire, which sends Christopher Lee mental. Understanding.
No! Understandably, yes.
Yeah.
And then they tie him up. They tie Christopher Lee up and start dragging him into the fire.
Wait. Yes. That is the most ridiculous bit. I've just put that big Chris Lee is felled by a number of small children. They all like leap on him simultaneously and he just goes, get off!
But they look like the cast of Bugsy Malone because they're all wearing miniature.
But I did think, oh, come on, you know, Chris Lee was 6 foot plus. He could have just batted them away.
Yeah.
But anyway, never mind. So yes, as Ross says, Chris Lee is felled. They tie him up. And as you said, we then learn, you know, Mary basically confesses and says, ha ha, you know, I'm not really Mary.
Yes.
I'm not this girl. I am the original woman who was in charge of all of this.
Van Traylen.
Van Trailen, and I Will Live Forever.
Yes.
So as John said right at the outset, it's such an interesting horror idea here. The notion, yes. Which is, you know, H.P. Lovecraft touched on things like this as well. Mm. This notion of the mind that lives forever and can be, yeah. You know, you can be reincarnated into different people.
Yes.
That really, Ross, what's it like, the Shadow Over Innsmouth and things like that?
The Lovecraft investigations.
The Lovecraft investigations, which are brilliant, by the way, isn't it? You know,
there's a new one at Christmas, wasn't there?
Yeah. Yes. So all of those have investigated that, the notion of, oh, maybe you could then plant your brain into somebody else's and take over. And that's a real. Yes. Yeah. So that's a really brilliant kind of black magic-esque story, which has just literally just been revealed in the last 5 minutes. Yeah. And you're like, you could have given us way more of this, way more kind of spooky and unsettling things with kids who are acting in. Oh, that's right. Because they say that one of the giveaways as to why they know she's not right is because she keeps using American words.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I was like, did she?
Yeah.
I didn't notice that.
At one point she said gasoline.
Yeah.
Did she? I didn't notice that at all.
Yes,
but anyway.
So Christopher Lee is about to be engulfed in the flames, and luckily a helicopter comes flying over with Peter Cushion in it, and inadvertently blows the flames away from Christopher Lee, and they set fire to Cassandra, who then flings herself off the edge of the cliff into the sea.
Well, before she does that, she stops to give a final curse.
Yes.
Yes.
She does.
And then, bearing
in mind what we said at the start, that there could have been a sequel. I suppose that's what that was all about, that bit. She says, I curse on you!
Yeah, and then
my plans to live forever!
And then in silence, every one of the other children just fling themselves off the cliff. And I was like, wow!
Which is brilliant.
This is amazing.
It's also worth noting as to how weird it looks as well. They obviously just got like mannequins of small children. Just footage
dresses
of
like
the
Vickers,
bodies of small children being like hurled off of this very, very tall cliff face. It's, like,
it's brilliant. It's way better than the end of The Wicker Man.
And I said to Beck, I said, that film was, for me, and I'm revealing now, really boring. I didn't know what was going on, but the last 5 minutes was amazing. I said, that was like, this is like giving it extra 2 points for me just for the ending of that film.
The ending is brilliant.
So many ideas.
Yeah. I wasn't watching this for this, I wouldn't have got to the end, I don't think. So I just think.
Oh, really?
It was, but I love the ending of it. And I feel like, this could have been an amazing, amazing film if it just was a bit more exciting.
Taut.
Yeah.
There are ways it could have been better, but I think it is still really good fun. I think looking at it through 50 years of time, it's obviously a nostalgic treat now, as people like to say. I read at the time, obviously, that the reviews for it were quite dismissive at the time, and I can see why, but I think now there is a lot of fun in it. And again, it's another, like, how many modern contemporary films come out now, genre films, with as many ideas as in this film? There's nothing. They just remake a fucking Color Purple or something again for the, you know, it's just like.
Well, Omen prequel I just saw a trailer for.
Oh, fuck's sake. And, you know, a lot of, I read somewhere online that someone had likened this to Get Out, and it's basically, it is the story of Get Out. You know, there's nothing original now, whereas this is, there's loads of original ideas in this. There's almost too many original ideas in it.
Yeah.
So what do we think of scores? Scores on the doors.
I'm going to give it a 3.
Yeah.
Because I really enjoyed, like, the where is this goingness of it? And there was some absolutely, I said, the cast alone. And it really is a curio. If you're into this sort of thing, guys, you've got to seek it out. It's really interesting.
Very watchable.
But unfortunately, as I say, you do think, oh, the promise here, the potential of what you could have done with this story. So, it's a 3 for me.
Yeah, I gave it 3 as well. Yeah. It was going to be a 1 up until, like, the last, like I said, at the end. But it was an amazing ending. I loved the end of it.
All right. The cats come in.
Yes.
Yay!
So relative to other things, what have I given 3.5 to, please?
You gave Curse of Frankenstein a 3.
Oh, right. It's way better than that.
You gave Quatermass 2 a 3.
Ghost, really?
Yeah, Ghostwatch are free.
Oh, God. My marking is not very consistent, is it?
You gave the Oblong blocks a free.
Wow, that's generous.
Terrible. Quatermass 2 is amazing.
You gave Beast Baby, episode of Beast Baby, a 3.5.
Yeah.
You gave Night of the Demon a 3.5.
Yeah. Okay, this is probably a 4 then.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I think that Quatermass 2 should probably be a 4 as well.
You can't retrospectively change them, I'm afraid. These doors are set in stone.
Yeah, I think this is, I mean, like we said, this is a kind of a cult favourite for us, isn't it? Because of all the stuff around it. You could probably research and write a really interesting book about how this film got to be made, because there's so much going on in the background to this. Brian Hales, the director, Christopher Lee produced it. The other guy, Nelson Keys, produced it. All of the cast is amazing.
There's a note here I forgot to mention. The scene with the fireworks and the bonfire must have been particularly traumatic for Diana Dawes, because it says here, Dawes returned to Britain in 1961. She narrowly escaped death at a Guy Fawkes at Night party.
What?
Where the fireworks are accidentally ignited indoors. The house was destroyed and 3 people died in the fire, and another one had a fatal heart attack, and Dawes was slightly injured after escaping through a window.
What the
wow.
And then they tied her to a stick and set off a load of fireworks near her. Dangled her over a bonfire.
Wow. Yeah. That's mental, isn't
it? That is a hell of a story.
Bloody hell.
And are you aware of the Diana Dawes treasure?
The what? The Diana Dawes what?
Treasure. Apparently, they think that she had £3 million hidden in various bank accounts around Europe. And she left her son like one half of a code, which would say where the money was kept. And there's been a whole like TV documentary about trying to decipher the code to find where all this money's hidden, but they've never managed to find it, because
that's mad.
It's one of those things where the code is almost impossible to decipher if you've only got one side of the key. So out there somewhere, the Diana Dawes millions are waiting for someone to
find them. There you are, kid listener. If you're stuck for something to do on these cold January nights, maybe you can try and discover.
Yeah, but you probably open up the safety deposit box and it would just be a load of Super 8 films, won't it? And
it would be it would be a creature made of sludge, which would then follow you back to your cloisters.
Spoilers for the most recent Ghost Stories for Christmas coming up now. So, something horrific. Did anyone watch anything over the Christmas period?
Yes, we did, Ross. We did.
Oh, what did we watch?
We watched the Lot 249.
The newest BBC Ghost Stories for Christmas. By friend of the show, Mark Gatiss.
And it was excellent.
You enjoyed it?
As usual, with his Christmas.
I really enjoyed it.
Superb.
I thought that they showed the mummy too early, personally. I felt like, because the mummy seemed to be, I felt for like, often on the Ghost Stories, they hide off the monster to the right at the very end of the view of it. But you did see the mummy quite early in this. Mm. There was another mummy, obviously, which was the big twist.
We should say spoilers before we...
Spoilers for the most recent Ghost Stories for Christmas coming up now.
I've reread the story. I finished it last night. It sticks very closely to the story, pretty much, except that it takes out the fact that... the character with the double barrel name, something Lee, his sister is meant to be engaged to Bellingham.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously what you have in the Gatiss version is more of like a homoerotic subtext going on.
Mm.
I think almost between the three of them, isn't it?
It wasn't really a subtext, John.
But otherwise he lifts, you know, not that he lifts in a negative way, but actual big chunks of dialogue are recreated and stuff. So that's quite interesting.
And they pop homes in it as well.
I enjoyed that part, but I saw that people on Twitter who are joyless and have very sad, petty and empty lives thought that was too much. But I thought it was good fun.
I enjoyed it. Yeah.
I just thought, why not?
Yeah, and I thought you looked like Holmes in the illustrations from the Star.
Yes, and I like the notion that that this was like the proto Watson. He could have been Watson.
Yeah. He could have been Watson.
I need a doctor. The idea of a doctor being at hand, and he's I thought that was great.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that I think it was a bit of a shame to kill him off at the end, because I'd be more than happy to watch six episodes of another genre series like this. Mm. There's nothing like this on TV anymore. We get one episode that's 30 minutes a year. Mm. Yeah. Please, TV commissioners, let's not have another series about antiques dealers in a fucking van going around Dorset. let's have a drama starring Kit Harington.
Loads of
people will watch, where he investigates stuff in Victorian Britain. It'd be amazing.
Make him the next Bond, I think.
Really?
It's too short to be the next Bond.
What was that show on Netflix where it all takes place in the interview room? The first one that had David Tennant in it. I think it's called Criminal.
Oh, I've no idea.
It's really good. Worth watching. So the whole thing is every episode is just in the interrogation room. So it takes place, and it's like you're seeing what's behind the two-way mirror and in front of the two-way mirror. And the first episode is David Tennant, and like for the first half of it, all he says is no comment. But you just you just know he's evil, you know, all the way through it.
I hope you hear other dialogue other than just no comment.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But when it's about them trying to work out what they need to say to him in order to get him to break that thing, and it's really clever. But there was an episode with Kit Harington where he's been accused of rape. And it's one of those things where you feel like it would be my absolute worst nightmare to be in a situation where someone's accused me of something, and like there's no way of me trying to, like, you know, how do I prove it if it's just someone else's word against my word? And it's really good, really worth watching. And seeing that after seeing him in Game of Thrones just makes me feel like he is actually he's really, really good actor. And
I've never seen Game of Thrones, but I thought he was very, very good in this.
Yeah. Yes. Speaking of Sherlock Holmes, I listen to a podcast at the moment, which I really recommend, called Sherlock and Co. Has anyone heard of this?
Watson, we're heading back to the road.
Watson, come on, bring him back to the road.
Yeah, 2-6.
Well, he's not coming with us.
He can, he'll make it. It's not too bad a wound, to be honest.
That Shelling's getting close. Move now.
We have to take him.
We don't have to do anything. Leave him here and move now. Now!
He's a kid. He's just...
What was that? What's he got?
What did you just do? Oh, shit. Run, run, run!
Get out of here! John! John!
Somebody help me! Somebody help me!
My name is Dr. John Watson, once of the British Army Northumberland Fusilier Regiment, now a true crime podcaster based in central London. I don't have much experience in criminology, so this is mostly a record of how I met possibly the most brilliant and bizarre person I have ever and will ever know. Join me as I document the adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
We all know in the original Sherlock Holmes, it was all Watson writing about Watson's memoirs, wasn't it? And then when
that's correct.
When Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss brought it back, he was a blogger, and it was basically his blogs. Yes. So now someone else has brought this out. That Watson is a podcaster,
TikToker.
No, he's a podcaster. So he's doing a true crime podcast. And it's all done, you know, so you can hear the microphone, him turning the microphone on, and a bit of like it banging around and stuff. It's really good. It's really up to, it's literally like the Christmas episode comes out at Christmas. So there'll be a story happening at New Year's when it's New Year's and all that kind of stuff. So it's as if it's happening now. His persona is on Twitter, so he will read out people's tweets and stuff like that, but it's still happening as well. But it's also, it's, you know, this sounds cheesy, but it is a laugh out loud funny. I found myself listening to it and actually laughing at it. The humour in it is really good. So it's good. It's worth listening to. The solved crimes, like looking at people's Instagram accounts and things like that and stuff. So it's a really good, modern, up-to-date version of it. And each episode is only about half an hour long. And they usually...
Is it based on any of the Conan Doyle?
Yeah, so they've had the mystery of the cardboard box, the mystery of... Something Bridge, Thor Bridge or something like, which I think's a, I think that's an original story, but obviously all made modern and up to date. But it's one of those things where, like, every time a new character comes on, I'm going, "This is Moriarty," and I know it's not. Oh, that's definitely going to be Moriarty. And so, but the irregulars are like homeless people. So like he would go and talk to like, the homeless people and stuff like that and like that kind of stuff. It's really good. I recommend that.
The Lucy Worsley three-part thing over Christmas about Conan Doyle was very good as well, if anyone wants to find that on the British iPlayer. Foreign listeners abroad,
get a VPN.
No chance.
And I didn't watch it, but there's the Hound of the Baskervilles live thing. So Mark Gatiss did like a radio play of Hound of the Baskervilles, but they filmed it, so you can watch him doing it. So that might be worth watching as well. Cool. Right.
So what's next time on
General Witchfinders, on episode 43, we will be bringing you 28 Days Later.
Will we?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you changed the list again?
No. You both agree to this. We are going to be bang up to date to the early 2000s with Christopher Eccleston in 28 Days Later.
I remember going to see it with Simon Griffiths, and he came out of the cinema and said, "I could have stayed at home and watched Casualty instead of this."
We'll see if he's right.
Yeah, and I'm going to try and release it in 28 days' time, so that'd be good. But until then,
very good.
Happy days
on that bombshell.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for the one-star reviews.
Yeah, don't keep doing that. It upsets me.
Keep them coming, guys.
Don't.
No, if I keep talking over Cleves, you can't edit me out, surely.
Yes, can you Cleves? Easily. Oh. On different tracks. Right, bye.
You have been listening to The General Witchfinders. Support the show and continue the conversation at patreon.com/generalwitchfinders. Subscribe and spread the word at generalwitchfinders.com. Farewell, and don't have nightmares.
Hi, it's Ross from the General Witchfinders. Did you know that I also do another podcast with my friend David?
Hello. No, I had phones before that. You're not taking this seriously, Ross.
David and I do our own supernatural research and investigations in our home county of Dorset. So, if you think that's up your street, why don't you give it a listen? It's Dark Darset, Darzet. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's not natural.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.